Hello, everyone. This is Dr. Pamela Brewer welcoming you to this edition of Thoughtful Thursday. Every Thursday, you and I have the opportunity to meet with and learn from an expert. And today's expert, I am excited to tell you, is Dr. Alexandra Solomon. She is a staff clinical psychologist and a member of the teaching faculty in the Marriage and Family Therapy Graduate Program and a clinical assistant professor, so she's very busy, at the Family Institute at Northwestern University. Her work on romantic relationship appears in academic journals and edited books. So we are about to meet a romantic expert. Dr. Solomon, welcome.
Thank you. I like that. A romantic expert.
You can put that on your business card.
You know I will.
Well, it really is very nice to meet you. And you've written a book that I have to say is so readable and understandable. And it is entitled Loving Bravely, 20 Lessons of Self-Discovery to Help You Get the Love You Want. Now, you know, and I know you know because you commented on it early in your book, that many of the books that abound, and they do abound, in the areas of relationship and romance, it's all about getting the person. Your focus is not on you, it's on the other person. And the tips and tricks and tools and games and whatever that people are recommended to play to get that person. You are taking the reverse approach. Why?
Yeah, well, it certainly is a popular approach to kind of ask the world or ask an expert, a so-called expert, you know, sort of like, what do I need to do to get somebody to love me, to get someone to date me? And I think it's not our bravest stance. I think our bravest stance is to turn our attention inward and really value cultivating those qualities within ourselves and becoming that which we are seeking, and sort of trusting the universe then that if we're doing our work and we are showing up with our kindest, most generous, most self-compassionate, connected self, that's how we approach love. And that's what gives us the best start towards creating something that can really go the distance. You know, if we begin our relationship with a game or a set of rules and tools and tricks, then where do we go from there? Like, sort of, what's our foundation from that place?
Well, that place, though, sounds a lot easier. If I can pick up a book or a magazine and it tells me 10 ways to get your person, I can do those 10 things and then my work is done.
And then all the while, love is standing on the sidelines laughing her head off, right? Because love never promised any of us that it will be simple, straightforward, follow any set of guidelines, right? So it's a myth that I think we all have a hand in perpetuating, that there's some sort of solution-based approach we can take to figure out or solve love. And I've been doing this, you know, we've both been at this for many years, you and I, and it is the longer I'm in it as an intimate partner, as a clinician, as a faculty member, as a writer, the more it's clear to me that our bravest work is to work on our own resilience, our own trusting relationship with ourselves, so that we can then show up and navigate all of the complexities that love continues to show from the first date to like the 25th year anniversary. You know, it's all to me about coping with, appreciating, and honoring the mysteries of love.
It sounds like so much work. Well, let's get started.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I know that there is at least one person listening who is engulfed in a huge sigh of despair because you're asking him or her to look at themselves. And how many people don't like to look at themselves, would much prefer to look without rather than within? So you've saddened somebody, I'm sure.
I have. Yeah, I believe that. I just don't know the other way. The thing that I do know is once we've gotten over that hump of sort of believing that it's about the other person and at least entertain the question of what's going on within me, once we've gotten over that hump, what we do is we go from victim to like author, you know, believing it's about everybody else really is kind of a victim stance. It's a rather disempowered stance. So for as hard as it is to say I've got to take myself under my own examination, that really is a position of tremendous power and authorship, agency.
So in fact, even though there's somebody moaning about the kind of work that you actually want them to do, the work that you want them to do on so many levels is freeing, it's empowering, and it absolutely takes away that sense of, I am a victim of life circumstance, and there are this many men to this many women to this many men, and I'll never find anybody. It takes all of that away.
There's no good ones left.
Oh, that's another one. Right. They're all married.
And
half of them are married and having affairs. Well, you know, so what? I'll be the affair. Because as you well know, I mean, we're certainly going off topic just for a second. There are many, many people and a growing number of women, along with men, who are having affairs while they're in a quote unquote committed relationship.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. And so much of that is about, I need to find the other. I need to go outside. So let's talk about going on the inside. You say that your relational self-awareness is the cornerstone of all healthy, intimate relationships. That's a quote from somebody you may know by the name of Alexandra Solomon. You may know her. Why, again, when you say that it's the cornerstone of a healthy, intimate relationship, isn't the cornerstone of a healthy, intimate relationship knowing the other person and being able to please the other person? No?
Wow. Well, not to me, not in my experience. You know, so the vast majority of the clinical work that I do is with couples, and couples oftentimes come in with a really deep conviction that what's going to happen is that, you know, partner A and I are going to work really hard and fix partner B. And partner B comes into my office feeling very clear that partner B and I are going to work together and fix partner A. It's so easy to slip into that mindset that this relationship would be just fine if you would just be different.
Right.
And to me, relational self-awareness is starting to recognize that when we start getting into that mindset of if you would just be different, this whole thing would be fine, starting to recognize that as a red flag. Uh-oh, I'm slipping out of my healthiest, most courageous frame, which is that my stuff plus your stuff equals our stuff. Always, 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 always. Always my stuff plus your stuff equals our stuff. And if we lose that lens, that like sort of golden equation, we're not in our healthiest, most courageous stance. You know, we're either in blame because we're focusing on if you would just be different, this would be better, or we're in shame, right? Like, I've gone and done it again. It's my stuff. I keep getting in our way. I'm ruining this relationship. Neither of those is ever the fullest picture.
And it doesn't really give you a lot of options.
Mm-mm. No, right. If either you're broken or I'm broken, you know, we're sort of doomed. And that's right. It doesn't give us money. It really cuts us off from options. Yeah. And it cuts us off from collaboration, right? It cuts us off. The stance that we need to take in our romantic relationships is not me versus you. It's you and I standing shoulder to shoulder, looking together at the complexities of our relationship and going, what's going on with that? I see it this way and you see it this way. What's that about? You want to unpack that with me? And that doesn't have to be, I think that can feel like it's onerous and heavy, but it actually can be really exciting to kind of look together and be like, how did it come to be that I can so clearly see it like this and you can so clearly see it like that? Like, you want to look together? You want to unpack, explore, try and figure this out together? That's a really courageous, intimate kind of thing for a couple to do.
So, in fact, what you're talking about is one of my favorite words, which is curiosity. Employing the use of curiosity takes away, there's no room in curiosity for shame and blame.
There sure isn't.
Let's talk about a process that you talk about, which is the name, connect, choose. What is that?
Yeah, you know, I feel like when we are, when we're inviting this kind of self-reflection, looking at ourselves, we need a process. Like, what are we looking at and why and how? And I think that different clinicians and researchers and teachers have different ways of sort of capturing how we raise our own awareness, how we look inside, how we do that. And so for me, the way that makes the most sense to me is thinking about, first we've got to name it, then we have to connect with it emotionally, and that process of naming something, connecting with it emotionally, then opens up multiple avenues of possibility. So, for example, so I love this James Baldwin quote that is, not everything that is named can be changed, but nothing can be changed until it's named. Until I, for example, name that I was raised, for example, I was raised in a family with an alcoholic parent. If I can't name that, then I can't even open the door to honoring the profound impact that happens when we are raised in a family with addiction. That's, you know, until I can be courageous enough to say, this is my story, this is what happened to me, I can lovingly, you know, call it what it is, and then I can look at the impact it had on me, how it shapes then how I show up for my romantic relationships. If I can't even call it what it is, I can't even start that process of looking at, so what does that mean? What does that do to a kid? How did I feel? What happened? What shifted and changed? What did I come to believe about the nature of love, connection, conflict, closeness from that set of circumstances?
So it sounds like, you know, you're kind of looking at a puzzle. And if the pieces of, first of all, you have to have the pieces of the puzzle in order to put the puzzle together. And it sounds like the naming of the family dynamics is creating the various pieces without judgment, just acknowledging them so that you can then begin to look at how they connect up and became and perhaps still are a part of you.
Yeah.
Is that a fair?
I love the piece that you're saying without judgment, because I think that's really important. I think what people get scared of is if I, for example, start to look at my dad's addiction, somehow that means I'm saying he's a bad guy. Well, and I don't think that's true. I think we can have deep love and struggle with the very same person. Or we think if we name it, then it means somehow that we're broken, damaged, and unable to love. And I don't think that's true either. So I like this idea of just kind of naming it, naming it without judgment. The without judgment piece I think is huge. Like, this is the truth of my story. When somebody grows up with a father like this, in my story, just naming it without judgment I think is an important piece. I think that can take a lot of the fear away.
And the sting on some levels.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So once you've done the naming piece, what's the connect and what's the choose? What's that about?
The connect is just allowing ourselves to feel whatever we feel. I think that many of us have sort of distorted relationships with our emotional worlds. I think, to me, the healthiest stance vis-a-vis our emotions is that emotions are, at their core, they're data. Emotions are data. We make a lot of judgments about our emotions. Well, see, I shouldn't be sad about the fact that my dad struggled with drinking because now he's sober. So therefore, you know, I shouldn't be sad about it. Or I shouldn't be grieving this because, you know, so-and-so down the street has it way worse than I had it. So I think we notice a feeling within ourselves, and then we go up into our heads and we sort of make like a value judgment of, is this an appropriate feeling? Should we be feeling it? And so to me, the connect part is just about noticing our feelings, noticing them exactly as they are and trusting them as data. It's not saying that if I feel X and I have to do Y, it's just saying, oh, there you are feeling X. Okay, I feel you. And just being with the feeling. And that's separate and apart from anything that we might choose to do about it.
And talk about choose. What is that about?
Well, Chew, I mean, I think chew looks different based on whatever it is that we're talking about. But it's just the idea that unless we have looked at the impact of our – so when we are out of touch with the impact of our past, I think we're prone to knee-jerk reactions. This idea that, men are dogs. So if that's my belief system, but I haven't examined all the factors that came to make me believe that men are dogs, they're going to hurt you, they're going to walk away from you, da-da-da, then I don't have a lot of choices. I'm going to be in a knee-jerk place of feeling threatened, being reactive. I'm sort of in fight or flight. But if I can curiously and compassionately look at how I came to believe that and honor the pain I suffered and the hurt that I lived through, then I can make some choices. I can say, oh, there you are, you know, fear of being hurt. Okay, I see you and I feel you and I'm with you, but I'm still going to go for it. I'm still going to do a first date. I'm still going to put myself in the ring or whatever that is, you know, whatever the choice we want to make. But if we haven't examined, we are prone to just kind of like the knee-jerk reaction, which tends to be a fight or flight kind of thing, attack or defend. With that compassionate questioning of why do we believe the way we believe, how do we come to see the world in this way, then we've got choices of what we can do beyond just either being in that fight or flight space.
Can you talk a little bit about the impact or the ability that many of us have to choose what we believe, which may or may not be the best choice for us, but it's what we believe and that's what we choose?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that oftentimes belief feels like the air we breathe. We wouldn't even call it a belief because it just seems like it's just a pair of glasses that we have on, you know? So in the Loving Bravely book, there's just a number of invitations to kind of pull up a particular aspect of your belief system and then just look at it. Maybe it completely is serving you well, in which case, stay the course and keep going with it. But sometimes when we pull up an aspect of our belief system, we realize it's actually kind of getting in our way. And then we can make some choices to modify it. I think unless we are looking at how a belief, there is choice in our belief system, but there, it oftentimes just feels like it's just is all there is. It's all we can see is just that belief system. The belief I'm going to get hurt, so I have to keep my guard up. The belief that it's not safe to let somebody, you know who I am.
It in so many ways speaks to the notion that we often create what we most fear. We tend to live what we find the most distasteful, but very, very familiar.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, we repeat those patterns. I think right, part of us is trying so hard to break it, but that stepping back and really honoring, like oftentimes, I mean, to me, I feel like in my therapy work, especially with clients, we're often just honoring the wounded kid that lives in all of us. You know, so that if we can develop compassion for whatever, the 8-year-old that we were who used to sit in our room waiting for mom to come, whatever that sort of tragic, hurt story is that we carry, once we start to honor that, like, oh, I remember what that felt like. I have such love and compassion for the kid that I was. That helps us feel much more like an empowered adult, you know? Then the empowered adult can be at the driver's seat making the choices versus the little wounded kid who again and again and again is trying to kind of prove her worth or prove she's lovable. So that little kid needs attention and care from us. It's in the book I refer to it as sort of parenting ourselves, right? Sort of re-parenting ourselves, which oftentimes we need the help and the support of a therapist as we learn how to do that. But when we can respond to those wounded parts of ourselves with just a ton of empathy for the ways that we felt as kids oftentimes, wherever our wounds lie, responding with empathy then kind of helps us break that cycle and make choices, kind of eyes open adult choices. They don't have to do it like that anymore.
Absolutely. Dr. Solomon, we're going to take a break. And when we return, folks, we will continue the conversation with Dr. Alexandra Solomon, author of Loving Bravely, 20 Lessons of Self-Discovery to Help You Get the Love You Want. We'll be right back. Alexandra, you give several exercises throughout Loving Bravely, and one of them is a then and now writing exercise. Can you describe what that exercise is about and what it's intended to produce?
Uh-oh, you have to remind me a little more. Then and now, which lesson are we in?
That's the one, I think it's probably one of the first ones in the book, where you ask the reader to write down the words or the phrases that captured the nature or personality of each individual who raised them.
Yes, thank you. So it's what we were saying before about how we can get stuck repeating those patterns. The thing we most fear, the thing that hurts us most, is what we tend to recreate. So yeah, in this exercise, I'm inviting readers to list kind of the qualities of their early attachment figures, their parents or the family members who raised them, kind of write down those qualities, temperamental characteristics that kind of capture those people. And then a list of the qualities, characteristics of their last one or several intimate relationship partners. How would they describe those people? And it just kind of gives a really visual, grounded way of tracking patterns and similarities. And sometimes we get stuck, sometimes it gets real clear how we've repeated it, right? We were raised by volatile, unpredictable caregivers, and we keep being drawn to volatile, unpredictable, intimate partners. Or sometimes we do sort of like a night and day flip-flop, right? Where if we go to the other extreme, if we were raised in a household with a volatile caregiver and we felt really afraid of that, sometimes we swing to 180 degrees the other way and we choose intimate partners who are really detached from their emotional world. And usually 180 degrees isn't the answer either, right? We've got to find some sort of shade of gray in the middle. But I think that making a list like that of kind of looking at patterns from our family and patterns in our romantic lives can allow us just to sit with some ideas, hypotheses, notions of how the past comes through. Even just that sometimes can be a real radical paradigm shift. Just really getting in touch with the fact that the past comes through for us. We are, in this very moment, the sum total of all the experiences we've had that have gotten us to this moment. That's just sort of the nature of being a human being. And that in and of itself isn't good, bad, right, wrong. It just is the nature of being a human being. So the more we can look at how the past informs today, the more we've got choices about what we want to do about that. What patterns, what do we want to continue and what do we want to break? There's another exercise of writing down three things that you really loved and cherished about your growing up experience. And then three things that you really struggled with about your growing up experience, three kind of qualities of the family system you grew up in that you really struggled with. And that's another way of really operationalizing, really fleshing out okay, what do you want to bring through and continue on and bring into this generation and the next generation? And what do you want to break, grieve, and leave behind? But unless you put it into words, put it into writing, you can't get enough distance from it to make it any different.
As you're describing the process and some of the exercises and the value of the exercises, there's sort of a sense of hope and excitement that you're not stuck in today or yesterday, that you really can do something different for your tomorrow, that it really is possible.
That's the most exciting part about being, I mean, all the places where I do this work, in my classrooms and in my therapy office, in my own life, it is incredibly exciting. I sit with 50, 60, 70-year-olds who are doing this self-awareness work for the first time. And the coolest thing is when I'm sitting with a couple and one of them starts to hold up that mirror, somebody who's been a chronic blamer, right, where somebody who can kind of always find a way to point the other finger. And as she starts to take the risk of looking at her own participation in dysfunctional dances, her own ways of perpetuating unhealthy cycles, as she starts to do that, watching her partner be full of love and admiration for how brave that is and how much it changes everything about the space between them. I think sometimes we fear that if we start to own our stuff, that the other guy is going to use it against us, or the other guy is going to roll their eyes at us. And that's a problem. Like, once, as we step into our vulnerability, we deserve to be met with a ton of compassion, because it's hard. So I often say that if you are doing your work of stepping into, you know what, I can see how when I start to yell, I can see how I shut you down and push you away. If the other person rolls their eyes or uses it against you, that to me is a big relational red flag. You know,
okay.
Like part of a healthy romantic relationship is that you can own your stuff and have it, and it that deserves to be met with love and like, wow, look at you. That must have been really hard to say.
That's a very different perspective from what often happens in couples. You're right. When it's about who's right, who's wrong, and it must be you because it can't possibly be me. I noticed that throughout our conversation, you don't say, do this, do that. But what you say instead is, I invite. Why invite versus tell somebody how you want them to approach this work?
Well, that's such an interesting observation. First of all, I think do this, not that, takes me out of the mix in a way that I'm not really comfortable with. Like, I have a kind of expertise that's been hard wrought through my own experiences in all parts of the room, as a client, as a therapist, as a teacher, as a student. So I don't, to me, there's a kind of like disconnected stance in me telling other people what to do that doesn't fit with my own way of being in relationship. That's one piece of it. I think the other piece of it is, in my experience, the moment I start telling somebody what to do, which, you know, I mean, who doesn't love every once in a while telling people what to do? It just doesn't work that well for me. I feel like what it does is invite reactivity from the other person. The moment I say, do this, not that, I think the other person's going to start to think of reasons why that's not going to work for them. So I think that this the directive stance, to me, in my experience, invites a kind of reactivity from the other person, whether it's my teenage kid or my client or my student. It just doesn't seem like my most effective approach either.
Gotcha. As the individual is doing his or her work, and you've talked about really the joy and the intimacy at a very different level when the partnership can look at and honor the work that the other person is doing. But what if you're in a relationship with a partner who could care less, who just wants you to shut up and do what you're supposed to do.
Right. Yeah, I'd be curious what you think about that. But to me, it's a kind of red flag for me. You know, I think we think about obvious red flags. Clearly those hold, right? Abuse, addiction, untreated addiction, right? I mean, I think to me, people who are in recovery, working their recovery programs, are some of the most amazing intimate partners that I have known and seen. But untreated addiction, untreated mental health problems, cycles of abuse, like those are kind of the easy and obvious red flags, relational red flags. But this is a kind of subtler red flag, which is a red flag about just somebody who isn't interested in taking a curious stance vis-a-vis themselves. Or who says things like, I don't believe in therapy, which always kind of troubles me, not just because I'm a therapist, but I think it just sort of says something about their stance vis-a-vis themselves. Like they sort of, in that stance, you're treating yourself like a black box. Like there's nothing to see here, there's nothing to look at here, you know, nothing going on in here. There's a kind of like brittleness about that is a worrisome red flag, because the nature of being in love with somebody and building a life with somebody is it's stirring. It's love is stirring. It stirs really profoundly deep parts of us. And somebody who can't reckon with that, I have a hard time seeing how. I mean, unless all we want is a real surfacey relationship, or a relationship that's about pragmatics and simplicity, you know. But the vast majority of us want from our romantic relationships a deep sense of friendship, the ability to kind of lean on each other, to find comfort and safety in each other. And for a romantic relationship to have those qualities, that emotional richness, you've got to have two people who can kind of say, yeah, I'm feeling really sad right now. I'm not sure why. Or, boy, that when you make that comment, that really triggers me. I wonder, I got to look at what it is from my past or from my belief system or my gender or my culture. Something about that really triggers me.
So you want to be at least mindful that if you are the person in this space of doing the work, of really working to love bravely, and you've got a partner who's basically saying, not my thing, you go do your thing, call me when you're done, that in and of itself that's a huge red flag, and it may be evidence of some of the disconnectedness that brought the two of you to the space that you are right now.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So how do you know when to stay and when to go? How do you decide? Mm-hmm. I want to go to a therapist or somebody, and I want that person to tell me if these three things are true, I can stay, and if these three things are true, I should go. I want that person.
Right. Yeah, boy, I there are certainly plenty of days where I wish it was that simple, you know, that this, if this, then this. But I think that's a real, you know, if we are going to use make this a real kind of concrete example, we'll do a gender traditional one.
Okay.
So she wants to do the work of like loving bravely, and she's partnered with a guy who has no interest in this. I think there can be, if she can really feel like she can bring her full self to the relationship, and she feels safe, and she feels like he's trustworthy, and he is kind to her, and he's honorable to her, and he's honest with her, that to me is wholly different than if he does stuff like get mad and retreat, or get mad and yell with no self-reflection. You know, like if every problem they have, he points his finger at her and says, I wouldn't have gotten mad if you hadn't done that. Or don't you see how I'm right and you're wrong? That's the problem. I don't think you get to have that stance and have any kind of rich relationship. If you're locked into that like right, wrong, win, lose kind of a stance, I just don't see how that relationship can go. I think what the price that she certainly pays is she loses out on the chance for kind of intimacy, closeness, authentic connection that comes from saying, yeah, I got really mad. I did get mad, and I wish I hadn't. And here's what I see now that I didn't see then, and I can understand this. I can put myself in your shoes and see it from your point of view. I want everyone to have that kind of relationship where their partner can say to them, no, I can. You've got a point there. I can really see your point. There's this researcher I love, John Gottman, and this is one of his really strong findings is the ability to kind of lean in to what the other person is saying. That I think there are lots of ways that our culture conditions men, especially, I think men oftentimes is sort of seen as like not very manly to lean in to her. Like, no, I can see what you mean. Boy, you've got a really good point there. But all those kinds of things, especially when men are able to say that to their female partner, those kinds of things are like water on a plant. It's like so essential for relational health and growth, is for him to be able to say, no, you're right. Yeah, I really see what you mean. Versus, it's this way, not this way. I'm right, you're wrong. It's this, not this. Good, bad, right, wrong, win, lose. It's not a real sustainable framework.
And in the ability to sort of lean in and be able to genuinely articulate, I see what you mean, I understand now in a different way, that doesn't mean that I agree or I disagree. It just means that I get it from the perspective that you have just provided with me.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Right, because as soon as he, for example, says that, I want her to, first of all, say, thank you, that feels so amazing to hear. And then also to say, I can see from your perspective how this and this and this. So I think that then the empathy, once somebody starts to kind of like step into that more empathic space, I think it really invites the other one to do it as well.
And if you're in a relationship where you are afraid to do that, for whatever reason, that's something that needs to be attended to, not ignored. You don't want to put that in the I should or I shouldn't do category because that will keep you stuck wherever you are.
Yeah, and people, I think, sometimes have really good reasons for being afraid to let their guard down because maybe they grew up in a house where if you showed any sign of vulnerability, it was viewed as weakness and you were punished for it, right? So a man who grew up in a house, for example, where if he cried, he was told to man up, stop doing that, and shamed for being sad or being confused or being deflated. He may have learned. I think we come by our wounds really honestly. Like I don't think I've ever met a wound that I can't find empathy for. So if his struggle is that he can't let his guard down and say, I'm really sad or I screwed up. If that's because he grew up in a house where screw-ups were harshly punished, he deserves some time and space to kind of unpack that, grieve that, and transform it. Like, I get why it's hard for him, but it doesn't mean he gets a free pass the rest of his life to never soften or shift that.
Right. Doesn't mean he has to be that way for the rest of his life. Dr. Solomon, we're going to take a break. And when we come back, we will continue. I have to confess that I took a peek at the ton of handouts that you make available to the readers of Loving Bravely. And I wanted to ask you about a couple of those. So we'll do that when we come back. Alexandra, as I was going through the many, many handouts that you make available to the readers of Loving Bravely, I was struck by one handout. Well, there are several that I think are very useful, but I was struck by one in particular. We've been spending our time today talking about intimacy and ways to approach it and ways to think about healthy connectedness. And the truth is that in every relationship, there are typically a couple of more characters in the relationship that we don't really think about. And those characters are, I would suggest, are our various devices. How many people are like entire, I mean, wedded very often, truly wedded to their devices more so than their partners or the rest of their world. You have a handout, Loving Bravely Technology Best Practices. I was so impressed when I saw that. Why do we need to know about technology best practices when we're talking about relationship between human beings?
Boy, yeah, it is a, I mean, I spend a lot of time at the intersection of love, sex, and technology, and it is a fascinating intersection. Like, I'll never get tired, I think, of looking at the really fascinating ways that technology infiltrates our love lives. And there are entire academic journals at this point that are devoted to looking at our relationship with our devices, and a good number of the studies that come out are about the impact of social media and technology on our love life. And so there are some findings that I think are really, you know, it's again just raising our awareness, like just naming what's happening between you, me, your phone, and my phone. And that frees us up to make choices, because especially if we're not consciously making choices, the default is going to be to grab that phone and just start scrolling around, right? Because there's an endless number of things that can distract us that feel pretty good. And our brains, what we're finding is that the way our brains respond to our phones, the word addiction is not completely wrong in that there is a neurophysiological reaction. There's like a dopamine hit that we get from scrolling Facebook, from posting on Instagram and seeing who likes and who comments. There's a physiological reaction there that is easy and quick and rather rewarding. So I put together those best practices as just, again, an invitation to kind of elevate our game and say, unless you make some really careful choices, the quality of your romantic life will be eroded by compulsive phone usage.
Well, tops on the list is unitask, which, you know, for many people is really kind of a dirty word.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I get quite convinced that I can listen to my partner while scrolling Facebook. It's very seductive to think that I can do both those things at the same time, and I can't. And the research is real clear that I can't. Because if you gave me, if I'm scrolling Facebook and listening to him, and then you gave me a survey, a quiz afterwards on what he had just told me about, I would fail the quiz. You know, even though in my own mind, I think I'm listening, I'm really not. We're really not. So, and there's some social psychologists came up with the term phubbing, phubbing. Phubbing is phone snubbing. That's when...
I love it.
Yeah. So... phubbing is when, you know, you're talking to me, but I'm scrolling my phone, and it's correlated with increased, you know, conflict, reduced relationship satisfaction. Like, it's not good for our love life to phub each other.
Well, now that you've given us, at least you've given me a new word to add to my mm-hmm. vocabulary. It's a
don't
great
phub
word.
Me.
Okay, there you go. And don't mispronounce the word when you're saying it either. Speaking of love, one of the technology best practices is set a time for swiping. So for those who are not clear what you mean by that, I mean, we swipe our phones all the time. What do you mean by setting a time for swiping?
Yeah, so this is when we're talking about dating and technology. So it is completely normal in terms of really, really common to use apps to look for potential romantic partners. That is completely normal now. You know, I think we're almost to almost 50% of weddings that happen today are weddings of two people who met vis-a-vis a dating app. So it's completely normal, common way to meet somebody. And here's where I get really close to saying do this, don't do that. But I think that love deserves us to treat the search for love with a kind of sacredness. So rather than opening up Bumble or Match while you're waiting in line at Trader Joe's and swiping left and swiping right and looking for your next first date, I think that love, that we deserve to keep a kind of sacredness and ritual around every aspect of love and sex and partnership, including some ritual around the search for love. So there, it is an invitation to have a time of day where you do your swiping. So you are looking for love. So it's, you know, I go, Bumble is on my phone, but I don't look at it until after dinner, on my back porch, with my glass of wine or whatever it is, and that's when I do my swiping and my looking for love. So you're just creating a kind of intentionality around the search for love rather than just like, so I have heard that there are students in my class who are swiping while they're sitting listening to my lecture. Well, I think that we all deserve more than just to be kind of recklessly and mindlessly swiping on each other when it comes to our love life.
Gotcha. What about the folks who are pre-millennial age and they grew up with, you are introduced to a real-life human being via another real-life human being, and it happens over time in person, like human to human, mm-hmm. versus the online approach. What do you say to those folks who really either don't understand the concept of this online way to meet people, or just find it the thing that people do who are desperate? That's another one I've heard.
Yeah. I do think that for people who are single again, who are back in the dating world, or who are a little bit older than millennials, I mean, I encourage them to explore little ways they could make use of technology that don't completely make them feel in over their heads. Like, could they try one dating app? And just see what it feels like. Kind of find a way to stretch themselves, but knowing that the old-fashioned way of meeting, quote unquote, old-fashioned way of meeting face to face or being introduced through a friend, is really legitimate. I think if they're feeling like it's hard to find potential partners that way, then I would say dip your toe in the water, put one app on your phone, and start to explore what it feels like. There is for sure a risk, I think for everybody, of getting stuck behind their screens. Like there's the guy who is the editor of the Modern Love column of the New York Times calls this soulmate in a box, where we get stuck in just a screen-to-screen relationship with somebody, and we meet them online, and we kind of stay in that fun, flirty, texting, messaging space for so long, then if and when we do meet face-to-face, it makes it really hard to cross that bridge from screen-to-screen to face-to-face. So I would say don't get stuck screen-to-screen. Like, use technology for what it is, which is a path to getting introduced. It just gets you from A to B. Okay. And B is really where the action happens. You know, face-to-face, over a glass of wine, on a first date. That's really the goal,
gotcha.
To get face-to-face.
You also offer a guide to self-aware sex. Talk about that.
Yeah. So my favorite way of thinking about sex is an idea that I got from Esther Perel, who wrote a book called Mating in Captivity. She's got a couple of great TED Talks as well. And she describes sex as two quote-unquote conversations that happen at the same time. And I put the conversations word in quotes. It doesn't necessarily, not talking about like a verbal conversation necessarily, but it's a conversation with each person is having a conversation with their own bodies. How am I doing? How am I feeling? How safe am I? How aroused am I? What do I need more of? What do I need less of? There's that conversation. And there's the conversation with the other person. how is the other person doing? How are they responding to me? So it's this sex becomes this profound experience of complete immersion in yourself and complete connection with somebody else. That's the best kind of sex, when both things are happening at once. Each person's in touch with themselves and in touch with the other. And I think very often we, without being mindful and really looking at our patterns, we lose sight of one of those conversations. Either we're so engrossed in our own experience that we're not empathically attuned to the other person, or we're so hyper-focused on the other person that we're checked out of our own bodies. This is, I think, very common with women who struggle to have orgasms during sex. I think very often it's because they're really lost and hyper-aware of what their partner is up to, how they're doing, how they're seeing me. What is he judging me? Am I, you know, they're hyper-focused on that and lose touch with what's happening in their own bodies and understanding how their own pleasure works and what they need in order to also have a pleasurable experience. So that's, I think, a vital part of relational self-awareness is sexual self-awareness. And it's something I think we don't talk nearly enough about.
I would agree with you wholeheartedly on that. I'm looking at some of the questions that you ask in the guide to self-aware sex. And one of them is, which I think is very hard for many people, is, am I in the present moment? Again, in this culture where, you know, you got to do 12 things in order to get one done, and then you have to do 12 more because you really have to multitask, because that's what, you know, evolved self-aware human beings do. The notion of being in the present moment is one that can be really, really challenging.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. In that way, you know, this is Marvin Gaye's sexual healing, this idea that sex really invites us into a place of mindfulness, where in order for it to be pleasurable, we have to be in the present moment. If we are fast-forwarding and thinking about what we have to do after this, and I've got dishes to do and this to do, it's not going to be very pleasurable. And if we're lost in the past, past regrets, past pain, past trauma, it's also not going to be pleasurable. But sex can become, I think, in the best case scenario, sex can become a kind of healing practice, a kind of healing space that couples step into, where they are able to, at least for a little while, shut the door on the worries of the world and just claim pleasure and claim play and claim humor and claim creativity.
You talk also about the importance of being emotionally connected with yourself and being emotionally connected with your partner. And if neither one of those are in place, that can have a profoundly negative impact on your experience.
Yep. Yeah. In that situation, then sex is re-traumatizing. So, you know, the numbers are quite high that many men and especially women move through the world with really unhealed trauma. And when we have unhealed trauma, then sex can unfortunately be a space that is re-traumatizing, right? Where if we are checked out of our bodies, but in a sexual experience, it can kind of reinforce that traumatized part of ourselves, and we can feel really unheard, unseen, and unsafe. So especially for trauma survivors, doing work around healing their trauma and figuring out how do I speak up for myself so that the sex I have right here, right now, today, actually heals and serves me versus re-traumatizes me and leaves me feeling even worse.
You also speak about, well, so many things that we're not going to be able to get to as our time runs away from us. But you talk in Loving Bravely about listening to yourself. And that's kind of what we've been talking about throughout our conversation today. I just want you to once again just talk about the value of listening to yourself, recognizing that yourself has value, and listening to it is a good thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's, you know, it kind of ties to what we were saying. It ties to two things. The first thing it ties to is what we were saying about phones. So one of the real downsides of being on our phones all day is what it takes us away from is our own daydreaming. Like we are, when our phone is put away and we're just sort of walking into the grocery store or getting a cup of coffee, that's when we daydream. And that's when we are kind of with our imaginations, with all of our possible selves and our wishes, our hopes, our fantasies, our fears. There's a lot of richness that goes on inside of us that we kind of silence when we are just entering other people's space, really, frankly, when we're looking at Facebook, right? We're entering into other people's spaces rather than our own. So that's one thing about listening to ourselves. And the other thing I would say is listening to ourselves also has to do with the quality of the conversation we're having with ourselves and how self-compassionate are we being. And I think each and every one of us deserves to talk to ourselves and listen to ourselves the way we would talk and listen to a very dear friend versus it's so easy, I think, to get hard on ourselves. I'm too fat. I'm not making enough money. I'm not this enough. I'm too much of that. I think it's really easy to not even notice sometimes how hard we are on ourselves, how many negative messages we give to ourselves. So that's, I think, a practice in and of itself of catching it, like naming it. There I go again. I'm being really hard on myself, taking some deep breaths and shifting to a place of compassion, choosing compassion, knowing that we can only be as kind to others as we're willing to be to ourselves. So even if we can't be kind to ourselves for our own sake, let's at least do it because it improves the quality of our relationship with the people in our lives.
Which is such an important piece that we very often lose sight of. The ability to listen to your gut, the ability to listen to your intuition, your own self, is that a place where someone might start in terms of practicing to love bravely, which is, I would suggest, an ongoing practice?
It's an ongoing practice for sure. And that listening to our gut is a really, there's a whole lesson about that in the book because it is so important. I think it's another reason why I don't love the idea of turning to a book and having some other writer or thinker or whatever tell you how to live your life, because it takes you out of your most profound seat of wisdom, which is like literally in your gut, like in our viscera. There's so much important information about what is truly a yes and what is really a no, and when am I safe and when am I threatened. There's so much data that we can glean from our guts, and when we start acting like other people know better for us, we're not taking very good care of ourselves, I don't think.
Alexandra, I'd like for you to let the audience know where they can get more information about the book and about the handouts that you and I have been talking about.
You can go to the publisher's website, newharbinger.com, and sign up and then download all of the materials that we create, all of the accessory materials that we created as part of the book, different worksheets and kind of summary documents that are really helpful as people go through the journey, what is really a journey. The book is really a journey in and through yourself, visiting a variety of places and kind of opening yourself up to deeper and wider understanding of who you are and what you bring to your love life. I also have a website, DrAlexandraSolomon.com, with a lot of video blogs, and then I have social media. I'm on Instagram and Facebook, and all of those links are on my website as well.
Terrific. Dr. Solomon, again, thank you so much for joining us today on this edition of Mind Talk.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been really fun.
Wonderful. Folks, thank you for joining us today on this edition of Mind Talk, which is brought to you daily as an educational public service. It is not intended to replace any work that you might choose to do with a licensed medical, mental health, or other professional. Mind Talk is produced by Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications. I'd love to know where in the world you are listening to Mind Talk. So send me an email to Pamela, P-A-M-E-L-A, at Mind Talk. mindtalk.org. That's mindtalk.org. You can listen to Mind Talk online by going to, again, mindtalk.org, or you can download the Mind Talk app from the iTunes Store as well as from Google Play. Want to, again, thank you all for joining us today. And remember, always, if it's unacceptable, then that's what it is. Unacceptable. You take care.